Hey everyone, and welcome to part two, the second and final part of our first Snake Oilers edition for 2019. This isn't the regular weekly Risky Biz news and current affairs show. This is the special podcast series we do here at Risky Biz HQ, where we take that dirty, dirty vendor cash and let security companies tell the audience all about what they do. Think of it as show and tell for security vendors. Part one of this Snake Oilers showcase was an absolute cracker. Go listen to that one if you haven't already. I published that last week. In this edition, we've got three more vendors vying for your hard-earned bread. We'll be hearing from Rapid7 on their Insight Connect product. That one used to be known as Command. It's a security automation and orchestration play, but how does it work? Who's using it? What are they doing with it? That's coming up in just a moment. Then we'll be hearing from Trend Micro about their 0365 mail security product. And this one is legit interesting for one very simple reason, and that is the deployment method. Most of the mail security firms basically make you route your email through them. In this case, what Trend has done is to create an email security product that just fiddles with your mailboxes through the Microsoft 0365 API. They have literally set up a demo instance for an enterprise on this one over a beer at a bar, right? It's that easy to deploy. So yeah, I suspect we'll be seeing more mail security products deploying this way. So Trend will be along in a little bit to talk about some of the bells and whistles that come with that product, in addition to just, you know, spruiking the deployment method. Then finally, we'll be hearing from Cybermerc. This is a group based out of Canberra in Australia. They've done a lot of enterprise deception, sort of hybrid hardware slash consulting work, and that's something they've got very good at. They also do a lot of cyber training, but now they're trying to market a managed service towards small to medium businesses, those with 50 to a few hundred seats. This is kind of like a managed honeypot service with some internal vuln scanning. There's a bunch of stuff in that service. That one is coming up later. But yeah, let's dive right on into it now with our first Snake Oiler this week, Rapid7. Which is actually the foundation sponsor of the Snake Oilers podcast series. So thanks to you, Rapid7. They have a bunch of different product lines across vuln scanning, EDR, SIEM, AppSec, all sorts of stuff. And they also have a product line that we're talking about today, which is in security orchestration, automation, and response, which players in this game quaintly refer to as SOAR. This product came to Rapid7 via an acquisition of a company called Command. We did an interview with Command's founder, Jen Andre, back in episode 515 of the weekly show. You can check that one out if you want. But yeah, Rapid7, since the acquisition, have gradually Rapid7'd this product, and now it is called Insight Connect. There are a few ways of looking at this SOAR stuff. The first is that you can take these tools and use them to formalize and organize your existing processes. And you can even use them to like construct processes and workflow. But there's the other way too, which is to take some of their pre-canned templates and apply them to your org. Think of a SOAR tool as something designed to connect people and tooling and manage the workflow around that. Rapid7's Jaden Cruz Montero joined me to talk more about Insight Connect, and here's what he had to say.
What's really important to start thinking about in terms of orchestration is what kinds of tools come out of the box for your teams to be able to pull together to map out their processes and reflect what is currently costing them time and money. You know, the only reason why if this then that or other generalized automation, workflow building tools aren't in this space currently is because they didn't have a focus on what would actually save analysts and engineers time. And so to get a little deeper into it, Insight Connect comes out of the box with a ton of plugins. I think we're somewhere around the range of 270 now. And when you think about 3 years of investment into plugins, what that translates to for security teams is effectively less code to be able to map out your processes in a visual manner such that you don't need to write any more Python or PowerShell scripts unless that sort of suits your fancy.
Let's try to connect it to something real, right? So what are the sorts of things that you're actually trying to automate, right? What are these tasks that you want to automate and orchestrate?
So if you look at where the industry started or where the SOAR market began, it really started with IR use cases. So things like phishing investigations, starting from your email security tool or emails heading your inbox, as of 2 years ago, already got a ton of traction. You know, not only are about 92 to 95% of all enterprise successful attacks on an enterprise network through spear phishing attacks. But it also represents a really common and easily relatable story that, you know, if you're a SOC or if you're just a two-person security team, you're dealing with these things. From there, I think the earliest use cases in the space were things like malware investigation and containment, as well as threat hunting and enrichment. And I think the obvious explanation as to why is that for all of these use cases, they were things that the analyst was popping between Chrome tabs, and they were trying to, you know, manually control C, control V indicators. But each of those tools had an API available. So if your team was tech savvy enough, you could have already, you know, 10 years ago, you could have already scripted and automated a lot of your threat intel lookups, as well as a ton of remediation. And so when SOAR began, it was sort of to present an opportunity to make automation first accessible to a lot of analysts and engineers and teams that were understaffed and under-resourced. And from there, we've only seen evolution, and the use cases today are a lot more fun.
Okay, so let's talk about some of them. I mean, it's interesting, too, that what you were talking about in terms of just automating a lot of this IR workflow, because one of the other companies that we had in the first part of Snake Oilers is a company called AlphaSock, and they've taken a lot of that IR workflow and turned it into a near real-time detection strategy for network traffic, like looking up things like, you know, age of domain, time series, things like that. Anyway, it was just interesting. Yes, just made me think of it. But what are some of these more advanced use cases? Because, yeah, we have seen a lot of the automation and orchestration stuff. You're right. It comes from that sort of IR use case where it's like you've got to do all those fiddly little things like domain lookups and trying to do time series on this and looking for odd traffic patterns. Are there any weird ports? You know, stuff like that. And you can automate that. But like, where does that start getting more powerful when you expand it out? Once you've built this framework, you realize you can do other stuff with it. What is that other stuff?
It starts getting a lot more complicated, in my opinion, in two different ways. The first one is when you have not mapped out your own team's processes, in particular surrounding your people. And so what we're starting to find as a company is when you take a case like automation-assisted patching, not only is that a technically complicated problem, but it's really difficult to be able to go into a company that's had a patching process for, you know, 10, 15 years, and then you're trying to teach them, you're trying to use their process to build it out in an automated fashion. What that reveals is the process is not locked down to a point where it can become programmatic. And I think, you know, to me, that presents an opportunity. Insight Connect and other SOAR vendors could see these gaps as ways in which we can influence the space and help teach about the patching process. An example of that recently, I was talking to a bunch of our professional services guys internally, and they get requests, for example, for ticketing solutions to group by a bunch of different things. Recently, we got a request to group by CVEs and tickets. So, you know, in one ticket, throw together all post-scan results by CVE. And according to our internal expertise, you know, they're trying to push to group by solution. And even more, the SOAR products kind of reveal the inefficiencies, not just in what's technically possible, but what the way that your organization currently deals with things. And that's not just IR at this point. So I'm personally really excited about those use cases.
No, the patching thing, you know, that makes a lot of sense, right? And the idea that you can have sort of templated processes for standard modern enterprise IT tasks also makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, I guess that's where you're coming from, right? Is you're able to, once they've got a, you know, some sort of central thing in place, you can start funneling people into, you know, acceptable workflows.
That's right, exactly. And I think the funny thing is people see SOAR solutions specifically because of the way that we market. You know, I'm not excluding Rapid7 here, but people see SOAR as that silver bullet. And when you get into the details, that's actually contrary to the value prop in the first place, which was, you know, your solution is unique to your environment. Now, notwithstanding heuristics around how workflows are deployed, you know, something like you just mentioned, you know, anytime you're doing some kind of network-based analysis, there's certain, you know, benchmarks that you need to hit. But, you know, the way that your team talks to each other, the way that we notify team members based on certain results is completely arbitrary. And not, you know, that's even putting it lightly. It's how has your team culture been built for the past few years? And that to me is really, really fun, really interesting. And it ends up becoming this really collaborative product where, you know, post sales is a super fun place to be. You're not selling a piece of software that is just supposed to import workflows and be done. You're selling, you're selling a community, you're selling collaboration, and you're selling the ability to build on top of these workflows that you imported on day one.
Now, you mentioned there were like 270 plugins for this. We've spoken about the IR use case. We've spoken about the patching use case. What are a couple of others? Because I think it's it's helpful to the audience to just, you know, try to make it a little more tangible.
Yeah. Okay. So I have two that I really want to talk about. The first one is one that we dog food internally, and it's all around our CI/CD pipeline. And this one is really fun because it really shows you what I was just talking about. Some teams, automation will enhance their workflows. It'll speed them up. It'll accelerate them. And for other teams, it's just a pain. It's just a pain in the ass. So you take our two, we have two engineering teams working on Insight Connect. The first one, they have a bunch of workflows in place that basically makes it so that anytime someone puts up a pull request in GitHub, everybody's being pinged in Slack. And so you sort of get this alerting workflow that's sort of aligns their pipeline. It also allows anytime a contributor adds
no,
code.
No, don't push that one. Is it that sort of thing?
Yes. Yeah. Or, you know, it's actually funny. It is way funnier than that. It's way more annoying. So they have a bunch of emojis populating in Slack that are saying, hey, we need eyes on this right now. And what that allows them to do is make it so that less people are involved with that sort of that rote, hey, I need two thumbs up on my pull request. When that happens and it's put through, they have the same kind of alerting that's hooked into Jenkins, as well as hooks into Insight AppSec and T-Cell, our other, you know, Rapid7 application security products. And in those cases, you're basically automating away the CI/CD pipeline. And a lot of people wonder, you know, how is Jenkins, how much more can you automate on top of a tool like Jenkins? And that's a fair point. But really bringing it to Slack, allowing you to do the kind of, you know, DAST scanning and bringing those results back to GitHub issues or Slack is huge. So that's a use case that I always find really funny because our other engineering team hates it. If someone told them on a daily basis, there's eye emojis in the chat telling them you got to look at this, culturally, it's just not a good fit for our other team. And so, you know, their workflows are a lot less pervasive. They're a lot less, quote unquote, you know, annoying. Sorry, integrations team. But yeah, that just really highlights, you know, that it really depends on your team culture and how you want to implement notifications to speed your team up.
Okay, so that was bring on the second one because we are running low on time, but let's do it.
Oh yeah, no worries. The second use case is provisioning and deprovisioning. Deprovisioning, we've called it the kill switch for a long time, especially in teams where the security team has access to responsibilities held by IT or HR in other companies. You're able to do stuff like quarantine a user, but across the board. You know, whether they're kill their session immediately in Workday. Be able to immediately roll their creds in 10 solutions in a row, and then automatically, you know, an AD remove them from some groups. That's huge. But the one that I think is slept on in the moment is provisioning. One of the customers we're working with right now, just on entering a first name and last name, it's able to generate for the user. It's able to generate a username and AD. It actually checks to make sure that username's unique. It then creates an account for them in Workday. It creates them email accounts as well as Workday and LastPass and Box accounts. And that whole flow, because this is a SecDevOps company, takes, you know, their one SecDevOps guy, you know, 8 hours to 10 hours a week. And enabled in implementing this workflow, that's saving them quite literally hundreds of thousands a year. And so, you know, there's all these use cases that, again, as you start to break down what's taking your time, it's not always these IR use cases. So, you know, just to bring it full circle, I'm super interested in the way that SOAR is evolving. I think, you know, templates are one thing, but being able to figure out what works for you and your company and use a tool that is able to match that to the way that your process actually is and not just what, you know, Rapid7 thinks it is or what the community thinks it is massive.
Yeah, I like the provisioning, deprovisioning one because, like, that's just one of those dumb tasks that everybody hates. So that's, you know, that's one that I'm sure is resonating in the eardrums of certain listeners right now. Jaden Cruz Montero, thank you very much for joining us on Snake Oilers to walk us through the latest with Command, which has become, I'm sorry, it's an Insight product now. What's it called?
Yes, it's called Insight Connect. It connects your tools.
Insight Connect. All right. Thanks a lot, Jaden Cruz Montero. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was Jaden Cruz Montero from Rapid7 there. Big thanks to him for that. And of course, I've linked through to more information on Insight Connect in the show notes for this podcast. Okay, it is time for our next snake oiler now, Trend Micro, and they have a new product out. And the really interesting thing here is how it's deployed, in my view anyway. Most cloud-based mail filtering forces customers to route their mail through the provider's infrastructure. But this is different. Trend's new product is specifically for 0365 email, and it deploys via some pretty smart API fiddling. Chris Taylor is Trend Micro's Director of Product Marketing, and he joined me to pitch Trend's new mail filtering service, which they've named Smart Protection for Office 365.
Yeah, we recently did a threat report looking at what we're catching beyond the Microsoft built-in security, both for E3 and for E5. And, you know, we encounter a lot of customers, actually, who are, you know, convinced that it comes in the package and it's going to catch everything that they need to. In fact, sometimes the purchasing department's making that decision, and they may be under illusion that because the SLA is 100% detection of known malware, that that's good enough. And in reality, what we find is that 95% of malware today is only found on one device. So really only 5% of malware is known.
Yeah, and it's like known to who, right? And when. So, yeah, there might be a bit of a perception issue there. I mean, I know that there's quite a few companies that do, you know, 0365 mail filtering, and they're doing quite nicely out of it, thank you. But I guess what you're saying here is people, the broader market might not necessarily know that it's quite as loose as it is.
Right, right. And so we looked, last year we blocked 42 billion email threats, but we looked just at the subset of customers that were using our API-based product as a second layer to Microsoft. And I have some examples of customers. So for example, an enterprise customer with 10,000 users using Microsoft E3, they found a total of 307,000 high-risk threats last year. That included 16,000 malware and 174,000 phishing attacks, including 2,000 business email compromise attacks.
So this is stuff that just slid past 0365.
Right, right.
So you have what you say is a solution for this, which is an API-based approach. Why don't you explain to us what you mean by an API-based approach?
Sure. So there's a couple ways that you can protect Office 365 if you want to add additional security. So one is to use a traditional gateway solution. And that's going to redirect your MX record and scan the inbound and outbound traffic. And APIs were becoming more popular. So we came out with one about 3 years ago, but we're seeing a lot of growth in this area. And the reason why it's becoming popular, it's really easy to integrate. So it's just, turn on and enable the APIs. And we've had partners enable this in a bar with their customer. And suddenly they have much better protection. And the second advantage is that besides the inbound as a second layer protection, it's also doing internal email. So if you have a compromised device or a compromised account and it's starting to send phishing emails internally, it can catch that, whereas a gateway wouldn't see that traffic normally.
So when you say it's an API-based approach, do you mean that you have a cloud service that interfaces with the Microsoft API or the customer's instance or tenancy of 0365 and fiddles around with it that way? Like, where is this API? Like, that's the part
right.
that I'm not quite
so
clear
So it's
on.
Interfacing with Microsoft API.
Yeah, okay. So the idea here is that you're not then functioning as a pass-through for the customer's email, is that right? You're just more granted access to the tenancy to go in there and fiddle with API access?
Correct. So it's at the mailbox layer. So instead of being a gateway where it's pre- and post-delivery, or pre-delivery and post-delivery on the outbound, it's at the API layer. So when it hits the mailbox, we can immediately grab it and make it hidden to the user until we finish scanning.
Yeah, okay. So this is a cloud service, I imagine. And what, you do this per mailbox? Is that how it works? So what, I've got like 10 users. I give creds for all those users to your service? Or how does that work? How's the deployability work?
Yeah, it's licensed on per user. So if you have a user that had two mailboxes, that's still one user. But the other thing it does besides mail is it does OneDrive. And that's important because a lot of times Office 365 users, they go to send an email attachment and they're given that pop-up, would you like to send this attachment with OneDrive? And when that happens, the email or the attachment is replaced with a link and it's sent out. And that file is being uploaded to OneDrive. And that's now a black hole for the email gateway product, which is trying to look for malware in that file, that attachment, or maybe compliance issues, because all they're seeing is a link and not the actual attachment anymore.
So just with regard to deployment, like how does this work? Do you just give Trend a sort of highly privileged account that can see across all mailboxes and OneDrive files? Is that how you deploy this?
Yeah, that's how you deploy it. The automatic way is during deployment of ours, you enter in your Office 365 credentials. We'll use those temporarily and set up the service accounts that enable the API access. But if you want, you can do those steps manually.
This seems to be a deployment deployment method that makes a lot of sense, right? Because then you're not sort of duplicating your mail infrastructure, even though, you know, most mail security firms, you know, they are cloud-based. I mean, generally it involves routing your mail through them. Are there many other AV companies and like threat protection companies that are doing it this way? Because it is an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, just in, I'd say about the past year, there's other companies who've followed suit with products like this. We came out with ours, I think about 3 years ago now.
Yeah. I imagine you get some bandwidth savings there because, like, you know, cryptographically verified mail from known recipients and stuff, you don't really have to look too deeply at that. Do you exclude a lot of stuff based on things like that?
Well, we do get reduced volume and inbound because the Microsoft, or it could be a third-party gateway in front, is doing a lot of the filtering up front, and we're a second layer. But then we get additional traffic because it's also internal email.
Yeah, okay.
And that's quite a few email.
All righty. So why don't we talk a little bit about what it is that you're actually looking for? Because there's one feature here of this which looks interesting, which is you're actually doing, you're building machine learning-based profiles on, you know, individual recipients, right? Or individual correspondents, I should say. So that if someone starts writing in a way that's radically different to how they normally write, in the case of like an impersonation scam or something, you can spot that.
Right. Yeah. The most common business email compromise attack is the executive impersonation attacks. They impersonate the CEO or CFO and try to get someone to make a wire transfer. So what we do is, if you can identify who are the most likely personnel to be impersonated, typically your executive team or others. And so what we can do is create a machine learning model for those personnel based on their previously sent emails. And it'll ingest about 500 to 600 emails. Doesn't take the text, just metadata describing writing style features like punctuation, sentence length, paragraph length. You know, I can probably come up with 50 different features, but the actual machine learning model uses 7,000 features. Features that, you know, only interpretable to the machine itself. And then if an email comes in and it says it's from, you know, Joe Smith, who's your CEO, and it's already passed our other checks looking for, is this from a similar name in a free email account and other ways to detect business email compromise, then as a last step, we can do a writing style comparison.
I wonder how effective that is and what the risk of false positives is there, though. I mean, and that they're the obvious questions that spring to mind.
Yeah. So far, we have about 5,000 high-profile users who have AI model or machine learning models trained for these, and we haven't seen a lot of false positives. One thing we see actually initially is that you'll find that a lot of times executives are using their personal email accounts to email people within the company. You know, maybe they're on their phone, they select the wrong account accidentally. So once you whitelist that, then the false positive rate is very good.
And have you caught many this way? Have you caught many attempted, please transfer $100,000 to, you know, to this account style emails, yeah, impersonating executives?
We have. So we catch, you know, thousands of these attacks with our other methods. But as a last step in using this, in the last, I'd say about 6 months, we've had 200 additional attacks. And while that isn't many, because of the average cost of a BEC attack of $159,000, that's still millions of dollars of potential savings.
Now, look, one thing that strikes me listening to you talk about this is I'd imagine that trialing this, given the deployment model, trialing this would be extraordinarily easy for most organizations, a lot easier than trialing other cloud-based services.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's going to be your path to sales there. Are you offering free trials on this?
Yeah, free trials. And it's very easy just to put it in and see is what you're using currently effective. So if you're using a third-party gateway, we have people who have a third-party gateway, not from Trend Micro or from Trend Micro, and are still using this product as a second layer, both for inbound and also for internal.
And so even if you're using one of the big cloud-based, you know, email filtering companies, you can actually throw this at it and see, you know, do a bit of a diff at the end and see what's been missed.
Yeah, the threat report actually has a few comparisons of people using third-party gateways and what we're catching beyond those. It also has a comparison of those using Microsoft ATP. So for example, there's one customer who uses ATP and this API product for 80,000 users, and they still found 738,000 high-risk threats last year.
Now, you've got some other feature of this, which is able to spot credential phishing, right? Like, how does that work?
Right. So there's a lot of credential phishing attacks going on, specifically targeting Office 365. And so they get in, steal the credentials, and then, you know, they can siphon off email and essentially spy on that organization without ever having to install malware. And so what we do, if we see an email coming in with URL, looks like it's leading to maybe a SharePoint Online file, we take that URL and we render the web page in the cloud. And then we use computer vision to look at the images, the login form, the overall look of the page. And if we think it's trying to mimic an Office 365 login site, then we can cross-reference with URLs and block that attack.
All right. Well, links are in the show notes for this podcast. People can go check this out, get themselves involved with a free trial of this. Chris Taylor, thank you very much for joining us on Snake Oilers.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chris Taylor there, and I have linked through to a free trial of that service in the show notes for this podcast. Even if you are already filtering your mail with another provider, you can actually put this on top and see what it catches in addition to what other providers have found. Hey, why not, right? Okay, it is time for our final snake oiler this week, CyberMerc. Risky Biz has a relationship with AustCyber, the grant-funded Australian nonprofit that promotes the Australian cybersecurity industry. They take companies they're working with and put them into slots like these. And for this edition of Snake Oilers, they have put us in touch with CyberMerc. CyberMerc is a Canberra-based business that mostly has a history in doing two things, running so-called cyber deception services for government and enterprise clients and offering training on their range down there in Canberra. But they're here today to talk about a new service they've put together. They've created a managed service for small to medium enterprise. It's part vuln scanning, part threat hunting, and they offer some simple managed honeypot services as a part of this service, which comes in at about $25,000 a year. I spoke to CyberMerc CTO Paul Nevin about what they're doing, and here's what he had to say.
We place a little red box, which we call a red zenit. It's a sensor that sits on the inside of a network. It's plugged in like any other device, grabs an IP address from the on the network, and it allows us to effectively come back in via a secure tunnel and start threat hunting, looking for evidence of existing compromises, identifying key assets in the environment, and look for potential vulnerabilities or likely locations where malicious actors would want to go.
So step one, drop a box on your network, do a bit of a vuln scan, have a look at what's there, see if anything weird is beaconing. So that's phase one.
Absolutely. The box is also collecting a cache of full packet data leaving the network. So we're able to actually look for behaviors, not just known bad signatures, the traditional antivirus model. We will actually go in and actually see things like any communications outbound to Russia at 2 a.m. in the morning would be a high confidence indicator that potentially a host has been compromised, and then we can further investigate the malicious activity in that environment.
So phase one is you drop the box, you have a bit of a poke around, you see if anything's wrong. Okay, say you mop all of that up, everything's under control. What's phase two? Because this is a managed ongoing service.
So we then move on to effectively a monitoring phase. And the goal of the monitoring phase is to identify very early on any future breaches. The reason we do that, if we can identify a breach in the very early phases as an actor has compromised a system, before they've actually stolen data or caused harm, we can reduce the cost of that compromise to the business. As you know, compromises are traditionally detected 200 plus days post-breach. We want to get it in the early hours or even days of that breach so we can go in and reduce harm, potentially even before the actors have stolen the data. And the way we do that is very simply, we place canary tokens in the locations where actors would want to actually steal data, or honeypots that potentially would be attractive to everything from a state actor through to a cyber criminal.
Now, you actually customize these honeypots per deployment, right? So one profile that I know you use is like, you know, in a retail heavy environment, you'll make your honeypot look like a POS system. What are some of the other profiles you support?
Yeah, so we will actively scan the internal network and look for those valuable assets. And they're different in every scenario, as you can imagine. Sometimes there'll be a point of sale systems. It could be SCADA infrastructure. It could be medical equipment. It could be literally any number of those sort of assets, or just a general file share. And by scanning those devices, we can effectively scrape the web pages and reproduce something that looks consistent with the existing environment. And that's very important in order to deceive the actors to interact with those honeypots, or to pick up those canary tokens and therefore trigger an alert that requires us to investigate them.
So honeypot, so this is like a managed honeypot and honey token service, which you're using to get high quality signals on breaches.
That's great. That's probably where it starts. It gets more complicated depending on the environment that we're trying to protect and the intelligence we want to actually generate for that customer. So an individual honeypot, or like a point of sale system in a customer network, is a very useful early detection system. But you can take this much further. And what we like to do is, having monitored the internal network, we can actually reproduce that back up here in Canberra in a virtual environment with some physical devices as well, and effectively drop malware into that network, let the actor go nuts, they'll steal data, cause havoc and so forth, completely safely in a virtualized environment or reproduction of that network. We can learn from that behavior and then actively provide that intelligence in the form of alerts or antivirus signatures or other type of intelligence that will protect not only that one customer, but all of our customers.
But that will rely, you know, that will depend on the customer actually providing you with malware that they know is specifically targeting them, or is this stuff that you somehow obtained through your little red box?
We use a combination. At the moment, the red boxes are passively collecting the traffic. We rely on the customers, or we educate the customers in many cases, to identify suspicious emails that come through and then just forward them on to us so that we can detonate them in our sandboxes. In other scenarios, we're actively collecting that malware and purposefully dropping it in these reproductions. So we're getting proactive intelligence. So we'll see a campaign against, for example, Defense Industrial Base. We'll drop it into an environment that we've modeled to look like a real defense contracting company, study what the actors do, and then use that intelligence and push it back out to those red boxes so we can actually detect those actors on the production networks that we're actually protecting. We will see state actors targeting whole industry verticals across Australia. If we're able to get similar intelligence on a state actor targeting one of our fake honeypots, we can apply that and actually see if they're targeting our customers or other segments of the Australian economy from that effectively a small amount of effort applied on a honeypot deception operation.
So really, though, if I'm a small business, you know, I guess maybe I'm less concerned with, you know, nation state actors, you know, targeting my dental practice. I'm more going to be concerned with just some of the basics. I mean, isn't that the basis on which people would be more likely to buy this?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we do discover, though, when we go into even accounting firms or small businesses and medical practices, as you said, is the sophistication of some of those actors is quite amazing. They're evading all the security controls they do have in place. They're able to evade antivirus, application-aware firewalls, because the actors have lifted their game to a point where they need to be that effective in order to achieve their mission. So by using deception, we can often get that intelligence and identify actors who have been established in those networks for a long, long time, potentially have stolen a lot of data. But we're getting that through effectively honeypots and deception operations rather than looking for particular signatures in those environments.
What's the uptake of this been like in the small to medium enterprise space? Because, you know, the InfoSec industry is littered with the corpses of companies who've tried to make SMEs actually spend money on this stuff. And, you know, it usually doesn't go well. So I'm curious, what's the uptake been like here?
Yeah, the uptake in the, well, as we're defining small to medium business, as I said, is in Australia, say from 50 to a couple of hundred seats, it is still slow. We've had considerable success in the larger enterprise game, but we've started this company trying to address the problems that are not just in the enterprise space, but into that, you know, the bulk of the Australian digital economy that, as you said, haven't really been addressed in the past. It hasn't been viable for a company to go in and try and sell a $100,000 firewall into those environments because that they're not willing or they haven't been able to afford that technology. What we've tried to do with our service is effectively build something we can take into a market that hasn't been monitored or protected and try and look for the actors, try and actually give them visibility into the threats. So we like to say we're giving them a threat hunting team in a box, but if you can imagine, we're giving them a very niche specialized service at a price point we think they can afford, but we'll get them real results and visibility into threats that are specific to their organizations. So the medical practices and those small businesses that are compromised that simply don't know that they're compromised is where we're trying to focus on.
Yeah, and the vuln scanning, you know, you do that as part of your setup phase, but do you also do some continuous vuln scanning on their networks just to, you know, if they miss a patch or whatever, are you going to tell them?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just missing patches. It's the fact that a new device has been plugged in on the weekend by the cleaner, or there's you know, suddenly you've got network scanning going, a vulnerability scanning going on that you're not actually doing. Those things are what we're actively doing with the internal facing sensor.
And of course, you're doing all of the usual sort of network metadata, comparing against feeds. You know, where are you getting your threat intel feeds from to know that someone is you know, communicating with a known C2 domain?
So we built a what we're calling a data lake, it's a term you're probably familiar with, back up in Canberra, where we're able to consolidate the metrics from not only our own honeypot data, but also commercial threat feeds. So we're leveraging a product from Anomaly to do that, which brings all the data in, not only allows us to compare what's happening against our own infrastructure, but allows us to share intelligence we're generating to other commercial and industry vendors. So anyone could subscribe to those feeds and actually get the threat telemetry that we're generating from our honeypots.
All right. Well, Paul Nevin, thank you very much for joining us on Snake Oilers to talk through your service over there at CyberMerc.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Paul Nevin of CyberMerc there. Big thanks to them for that. And you can check them out via the link in the show notes for this podcast. And that is it for round one of our first Snake Oilers podcast for 2019. We've got another one of these coming up, I think, around September, October. I do hope you found this one useful. I'll be back next week with another weekly news episode. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.